Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill and Redefine's Executive Editor Matt Ladner have an important conversation about a major element to the future of learning, ESAs, or Education Savings Accounts. The two discuss the past, present, and future of ESAs. Ladner was a part of the original team that created the first ESA program in Arizona, and both men believe ESAs are the best way to empower families to take charge of their education of their children. The two also discuss the rise of the pandemic pods, micro schools, teacher empowerment in the era of ESAs, and more. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So I'm really excited to have Matt Ladner with us today. Matt is the executive editor of Redefine, the blog at Step Up for Students. But more importantly, Matt has been a strategic leader, an operational leader in the EdChoice movement for decades now, and certainly is one of the great thought leaders in the movement, someone that a lot of us look up to as a visionary. And so Matt, welcome to Redefine blog.
Well, thanks for having me.
So today we're going to talk about ESAs, and we're going to title this The Past, Present, and Future of ESAs. You are, rightly or wrongly, seen as the father of ESAs, I think rightly. So let's talk about how things got started. What was the impetus to begin the development of the first ESAs, which came out of Arizona?
It's wrongly. I was not the father of ESAs. I was a part of the original team that created the first program. But there had been, like, multiple people before had suggested ESA type of things. Jack Koons and Steven Sugarman wrote a whole book about it in 1978. Milton Friedman wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal in 2003 where he talked about partial vouchers. These, however, were things that we were completely unaware of in Arizona when our school voucher program for children with disabilities was struck down by the Arizona Supreme Court. It got struck down on the basis of a Blaine Amendment. Our particular Blaine Amendment says that public funds cannot go to a private or religious school. If it had only said religious school, we probably could have appealed that to the United States Supreme Court. But since it did not discriminate on the basis of religion particularly, it discriminated against all private schools, right? We were in a pickle. It was actually Dan Lips, who was at the Heritage Foundation, wrote a study for us. I was working at the Goldwater Institute at the time, proposing an ESA-type program. And Dan deserves a ton of credit for this because not only did he write that study, he was constantly in our ears about, hey, you need to do this. But it was after the loss of the Arizona Supreme Court that sort of the light bulb went off and we're like, wait a minute, this program design would make the Blaine Amendment less of a problem because this program would take money and deliver it directly to parents. Parents would then have multiple options of what to do with the money. Going to a private or religious school is only one of those options, right? And we went and watched the oral arguments in the Supreme Court, in the Arizona Supreme Court. There was a direct question put to both lawyers in that proceeding where, you know, they asked, well, what if the state of Arizona just gave $5,000 to the parents of children with special needs, would that violate this Blaine Amendment? Tim Keller from the Institute for Justice said no. They went to the opposing attorney. He also said no. Oh. And the Supreme Court justice that posed a question, Justice Hurwitz, asked him, well, why not? And the person said, well, if you did it that way, you could take that money. You might go spend it on something else. You might spend it on a tutor or whatever. This program, right, this was his job, right, it was to say this program was unconstitutional because the only way you could use it to go to a private school, having seen that oral argument, we really said, okay, this is it, we can do this. The subsequent legal challenges in the Arizona court system to the program failed. So in Arizona, vouchers are still unconstitutional, but ESAs have been affirmed by the courts as being constitutional. So we kind of, you know, just through a random process of seeking problem, solutions to problems, we came upon a model of school choice that we think is superior to a voucher in a lot of ways.
Well, let's define our terms a little bit. I should have started off with defining ESAs. ESA stands for Education Savings Account. Some people also say Education Scholarship Account, but I think Educational Savings Account. First of all, why'd you name it Educational Savings Account? What was the thinking behind that?
One of the key features of an ESA is the ability to, in a voucher, it's kind of an all or nothing proposition, right? I'm either going to take all of my money to this school or I would take all of my money to that school. In an ESA format, it basically kind of creates the opportunity for parents to consider opportunity costs and to consider sort of a multi-vendor education setup. So the question shifts from, do I want it all here to all there, to what else could I do with this money that might serve my child better, right, than spending it all here or all there. Now, plenty of people in ESA programs actually wind up spending all their money at a single school.
Like tuition and fees, yeah.
Yeah, tuition and fees, but not all of them. And it's a growing trend not to do that.
Right.
The savings part is crucial, and the ability for parents to save some of their money for future higher education expenses sort of heightens that sense of, I can spend money on, this, that, or other thing, but is it worth it? Is this the optimal way for me to maximize the education utility for my child in a way that that doesn't happen otherwise? So I guess, the savings part of it can take a variety of forms. It could be the ability to put money into a prepaid college tuition program. Sometimes it's just the ability to roll funds over from year to year. For instance, people that are going to private schools, there's an increased cost to go to high school, from middle school, right? So some parents will save money for, in anticipation of more expensive costs in future years. But that's kind of the whole idea behind this is to have, as flexible a system as possible. One of the early analogies that we used, and I think it's still very useful to illustrate to people, is that a voucher program is a lot like a rotary telephone, right? And a rotary telephone was an amazing piece of technology for its time, right? It allowed you to do something that was almost magical, right? You could pick up this device and talk to someone on the other side of the planet, okay? That was great. In a voucher program, it does one thing, and it does this one amazing thing really well, which is allow parents to choose different schools that would otherwise be inaccessible to them. The ESA program is more like a smartphone or an iPhone, right? In that it does that one amazing thing, right? But it also does a lot of other things, right? Where parents can use these monies to hire tutors. They can hire therapists, right? They can use the program to pay for community college tuition or a variety of different things. And like a smartphone, if somebody comes up with a new use, we can basically download the app and include it in the program, right? So when the Nevada legislature passed their ESA program, which unfortunately ultimately was not funded and faced the difficulties in the courts, they could really use that program right now, by the way, because the Clark County school system is providing less than half the normal instruction that a child would receive in a year, and that's where almost the vast majority of Nevada kids go. So it's unfortunate the program's not there to serve them. But they decided in Nevada they wanted to include transportation. They worked out some details. They decided we have to have some limits on this, so it's a certain dollar amount. But it was not all that dissimilar from just downloading, an available use, an allowable use is similar to an app being downloaded to an iPhone, and now it does something different, or it's allowed to do something different.
So ESAs are really leading the transition from school choice to education choice. In step up, we sort of stop using school choice and we use education choice because we run two ESA programs, and parents are clearly making choices beyond schools. Like you said, the first couple years of the Gardner program, which is our big ESA program, about 95% of the money was being spent on tuition and fees. We're probably now down into the low 70s, maybe upper 60s.
Right.
And so you see this transition as people get more comfortable and get smarter about how to spend their money and be very cost conscious, which is part, I think, what the motivation is in letting the money roll over.
Right.
So talk about what you see today. I mean, what's been the evolution of ESAs, and what do you see today? What are you pleased with? And what do you see as the improvement opportunities of where we are today with ESAs?
I mean, ESAs are the most flexible and versatile tool from a public policy standpoint to, you know, really empower parents to take charge of the education of their child. The pandemic, I mean, it's almost like it's definitely something you want to have in a pandemic, right? Now, unfortunately, very few people do at this point, right? I mean, it's the clear niche that ESAs to this point have filled is with regard to the education of special needs children. That is appropriate. You know, the initial promise of federal special education law is to provide an individual education plan for all children needing that. The track record of the public education system in actually doing that is, despite a lot of very well-meaning people that have tried very hard at this, my own mother was a special education teacher, despite that has not really turned out that well, right? The all too often, the special education system is sort of an invitation for conflict between parents and school districts, and it involves lawsuits and, you know, a lot of frustration. But the ability, I would say, you can't really have an individual education plan without the ability to choose who provides what kind of services to your child. So I don't think it's an accident that the ESA programs that we see today, Arizona's primarily serves special needs children, but also some different education groups. Florida's is a special needs program. But looking beyond that, right, I mean, I think that the pandemic has really, I think when we look back at things, we're going to see the year 2020 as a watershed moment. There was a public education system that existed before 2020, and there's going to be a different one that exists after, you know, moving forward. I think that in some ways this will be subtle at first and grow over time. Some ways it won't be so subtle, right? The advent of micro schools and pandemic pods has been fascinating to watch. I don't think any of us really anticipated it. It was truly organic and spread around the country. I was as shocked as anyone when I saw, you know, pandemic pods spreading across the country. Today on People magazine, on the cover, there's a well-known celebrity DJ who is talking about how he started a pandemic pod in his guest house and how great it is and how much he loves it. And they quoted this person as saying, you know, I was watching my kids doing Zoom learning and I thought there's just got to be a better way than this, right? And now he's doing a pandemic pod with another family, and they love what they're doing and they think it's great. So a poll recently done of parents by EdChoice found that 35% of parents are participating in a pandemic pod. That's shocking to me, right? Another 18% of their samples said that they were looking to join a pod or to create one, right? That gets you into a majority, right? There's also a number of polls from around the country that show that a sizable majority of people have the sentiment that normal is not worth returning to, right? They don't want things. I mean, all of us want things to return to normal in some sense, right? I think like all of us are at the end of our ropes with the pandemic. People want things to be very, very, you know, better and different than before. There's a big demand, especially among families of color. You know, when you put poll questions to them, basically what they'll tell you is that no, we're not interested in going back right now. What we're interested in is better distance learning. Okay, so some of the fascinating trends that you can see out there and sort of best practices being built, because mean, basically the pandemic threw everyone into the deep end of the pool and forced experimentation, right? And a lot of that is not going so well, but some of it is, right? That's kind of the normal course of things. So I'm fascinated by the model of distance learning that Success Academy did in New York City. They closed early. They created a differentiation between instructor roles, where some people were the equivalent of a college professor giving a big introductory lecture, and some of their other faculty. So this was all happening online, obviously. So they had, if we're talking about seventh grade math, the best seventh grade math teacher in the entire system of schools, not just your individual school, but all Success Academy schools, would be giving a math lecture. And then they would divide the kids, say, let's just imagine that's 200 kids. And then with the touch of the button, they could divide those 200 kids, into 20 groups of 10, each with a teacher in it, to do small group discussions, right? They monitored assessment data because they were still giving assessments, right? They detected kids who were starting to fall behind, and they would schedule individual tutoring with them, right? This is, if you think back to the naive enthusiasm stage of massive open online courses or MOOCs, right? About a decade ago, right? And it's about a decade ago that Stanford University put a master's level artificial intelligence course available for free onto the internet, and there were hundreds of thousands of people taking it, and we all thought, wow, look at that, we're all gonna be super geniuses with three PhDs and learn whatever we want, whenever we want, right? I don't want to say that MOOCs aren't important, because actually they are. I don't think we could have even tried to do this distance learning stuff during the pandemic without that kind of experience backing us up, right? But what we kind of quickly figured out is that, MOOCs can be not that different than watching documentaries on YouTube, right? You can learn a lot by watching documentaries on YouTube, but not very many people are going to sit there and consume, hours upon hours of documentaries on YouTube. And likewise, the percentage completion rates on MOOCs are very low, right? There's a whole thing there to work out with credentialing and all that sort of thing. Well, the Success Academy model is basically the opposite of a MOOCs, right? The instruction is given live. It is very high touch, right? It is like a lot of interaction, a lot of small group interaction, a lot of, and when necessary, one-on-one. The Success Academy distance learning model is by itself potentially revolutionary, right? If you think about Success Academy having a lottery for admission, right? Because demand for Success Academy is larger than their ability to supply it. I can't see any reason why Success Academy could not offer the digital version of themselves to lottery winners and lottery losers, right? Because it's not with enough demand to sustain a digital faculty, right? It's not limited in that fashion. However, the other big pandemic trend that is going on, at least I see in my home state of Arizona, but it's obviously going on in different ways everywhere, is the rise of the micro school. The firm Prenda in Arizona has, it serves both ESA students with micro schools. These are schools of about 8 to 10 kids typically, grades K-8 only. And sometimes these kids are, it's a purely private micro school. The kids are using ESAs. But more often, the kids are actually enrolling in the distance learning program of a district or charter school, okay? And the way that's where you get, when they enroll in the distance learning program or participate in the ESA program, this is where the public funding is coming in to address equity issues, right? And of course, when we saw pandemic pods explode around the country, the attempt of opponents was to decry them because they were, inequitable, that they would lead to bigger gaps, that they were a privilege, something that only wealthy families who had the private funds to privately hire their own teacher, basically, could participate in. But unfortunately, I think this, where this leaves our opponents of this trend is in saying that these equity issues are so important that we absolutely refuse to do anything about them, right? Because pandemic bonds have happened all over the country, and they've happened regardless of what the public policy in the state is, right? And they're a reality. And so I agree that there are equity issues, and they're very real, and they need to be addressed, but they need to be addressed by providing public funds for lower-income families so that pays the in-person teacher, right? That provides device access. This provides internet access. These are actual issues that need to be dealt with. But a lot of the criticism of the pandemic pods was focused on, well, we shouldn't even allow this to happen at all. Well, you know, good luck with that. It's already the genie's out of the bottle on that. So I one thing that I think that we're likely to see over the next year or two is a marrying of these two processes, right? If you could marry the micro school model with, think of it as a digital mothership and a pod model, right? Because when you visit these micro schools, the thing that just absolutely slaps you across the face is, you know, when you walk in the door, is how much fun they are, right? Like, these are really tight-knit communities. The kids know each other very well. They're very close. The ones I've seen have focused on sort of academics in the morning and then an associated group of hands-on projects in the afternoon. So the idea is you learn stuff and you apply stuff. The kids have a lot of fun doing those projects. I think what we're going to see over the next year are a number of high-quality providers that can provide that digital mothership, creating different flavors and sort of increasing the pluralism available in the micro school space, right? And this represents a different path to scale than, say, the traditional charter school model, which has, you know, really struggled with raising the money necessary to keep building, you know, facilities, right? That's been a big inhibitor to charter school growth. This model of education could scale in a different way, you know, sort of smaller bites, but more of them, I think, is what we're likely to see. So the next decade will be very interesting to see how this unfolds.
That puts a lot of challenges on the opponents because, as you said, they're attacking these learning pods as inequitable because only affluent families can participate. But then when you start offering ESAs or even vouchers, now they're in a dilemma because now they have to oppose those. Mm-hmm. But those are the things that create equity. So they're going to have to, you know, put them in a dilemma there. The Success Academy is interesting because obviously the way to try to stop their expansion in New York has been physical plants.
Right.
And, you know, the mayor there has worked really hard to deny them access to available space. But if they can expand without having to have the space through these pods,
right,
then it puts an even more challenge on some of the opponents to education choice. How do you block these guys from expanding? So you can see the pressure building as there's many different avenues to empower families and provide them with the tools they need to customize their education. It puts more and more pressure on the status quo.
Right.
To deny people access to these opportunities.
Right. I don't think that the digital version of Success Academy would compete very well against in-person Success Academy. However, I think this is just my own spidey sense talking here, that a pod and mothership version of Success Academy might be something that current Success Academy students and families might prefer to, you know, getting on a subway and going all the way down to what, you know what I mean? Like, they may very well may prefer to, some of them may prefer to do that. And when they do, they open up more space for kids that are on the wait list, right? So, you know, developing new ways to scale. I mean, another way to think about this, Doug, is what we see happening in micro schools now is a way to fix the problems inherent in digital learning, right? And I think that's what are these social institutions that you could put around a digital delivery of some educational content that actually makes it work, right? sitting around watching MOOCs by yourself in a basement on a computer, that's not a very enriching, appealing vision of what education is supposed to be. Education, most people believe. Now, of course, there's always exceptions. There's kids that do really well with digital learning. But, you know, there's also kids that pass the state bar exam at year 18. And, you know, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, most kids want and need classmates. They want and need in-person instruction. So if you think about the Success Academy model we just talked about, basically what you can think about is a digital mothership, and with the in-person role being played by an in-person guide, right? So instead of, you know, both online, the second one is in person. You open up the, because these things are small, you can make use of spaces that are, far more readily available than $25 million new buildings. And you also create the opportunity to do just a lot of projects, student debates, science projects, visits to museums, field trips, all of these things, you know, get kind of freed up. So it's not hard to imagine when you visit a few of these places that this will be viewed as a very appealing vision of education by a great many people. And the familiarity with it has increased, but I think it will increase further.
As you were talking, I remember in college, when I was in graduate school, it was common to have a large lecture class with maybe 300 or 400 kids in it, and then they would break them into small groups. And as a TA, graduate assistant, I would have a group of 10, 12, 14 kids, and we would do a small group class that built on the large group lecture. So this is really the same model.
It is.
As opposed to bringing all the kids into a large lecture room, you do the lecture online,
right?
And then the breakout group is still the breakout group, and
right,
you still meet physically. So we've been doing this actually for years, just
yes,
in a little different environment.
Exactly. And I was a TA as well, right? You get your 12 to 14 kids in, and they're like, what was that goofy professor talking about?
Right.
I don't understand. He was speaking Sanskrit, blah, blah, blah. And you say, okay, yeah,
right,
this is what he meant. And,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that kind of hands-on interaction is absolutely vital to a well-functioning, because like none of us can just sit there and watch lectures and get it all, and everyone needs guidance, everyone needs help, everyone needs fresh perspectives or different ways of looking at things to really get things. And that's how you avoid sort of building cracks in your foundation, as Sal Khan talks about that, right? You know, if you take a test and you get a 70 on it, that means you didn't learn 30% of the stuff, and now you're going forward without 30% of what you need, right? The interaction process is what stops that from happening and is what's possible. And the great thing about ESAs is it just widens the universe of people that can do that for you, whether that's in school or in private tutors, Kumon Mathnasium programs. Just the possibilities are endless, and this, I think the direction that we'll be heading is in a very customized sort of future for education. I think that has just a ton of opportunity actually for teachers, right? The teachers have been one of the great victims of this sort of standardized big bureaucratic delivery system. I was listening last year to a radio program in Phoenix, Arizona, and a gentleman called into this talk radio program. He identified himself as having been a 44-year veteran classroom teacher in Arizona.
Wow.
Okay. And they had I think this guy was a random caller, but they had a long conversation on the air. And this person said, the problem with education today is not money, because money has always been tough. And that's true. In Arizona, money has always been tough because, we have a lot of retirees and a lot of kids and not very many people paying the bills in the middle. But he said, the problem with education is not money, because money has always been tough. The problem with education today is that the joy has been strangled out of the profession. I just sat there with my jaw agape having heard this. He's right, right? I think you talk to any teacher that you know, left, right, center, teacher union oriented, non-teacher union oriented, whatever, they all tell you different versions of that story, right? And there's no need for education to be that way. And a lot of what we see going on in these small, tight-knit education communities is teachers finally getting the opportunity to deliver what they see as a high-quality, enriching education program that, you know, is kind of what motivated them to get into education in the first place, right? Nobody in the world, you know, went to college for 4 years and endured everything that teachers have endured and wake up in the morning going, I can't wait to get to school today so I can miseducate kids and make sure they don't learn how to read. That's not how this happens, right? These people are a part of a dysfunctional system, right? And they are victimized by that dysfunctional system almost as much as the kids, right? You know, they're adults, so they're more responsible for their decisions. But this is not a system that serves their interests well. And it's a system that doesn't serve the interest of far too many kids well. So I think we're in the early stages of figuring out what practices and what public policies we can do to make things far better than they are today.
I wonder how school districts are going to respond. Would a school district look at the Success Academy model in New York City and say, hey, we can learn from this? Put on your optimistic hat and let's fantasize a little bit. Can you see a situation where school districts look at this and as opposed to fighting it, embracing it, and how it might work in a school district?
Yeah, I can. There's a high-quality school district in the Phoenix area called Kyrene. There was actually a change of state law that was made a couple years ago that allows students to enroll in the digital learning programs of districts that they don't reside in, right? So this is kind of this thicket of underbrush of old antiquated laws, right? We happened to get rid of that one a couple years ago. Well, the Kyrene School District, you know, this fall when school started, was advertising to students around the state, like every kid can be a Kyrene kid, right? For this very reason, right? There's no reason why, like the possibilities on that front are in terms of the ability to scale instruction are there. The next step, however, I think would be to create these small learning communities around this, right? And I think this is, again, I can't prove this at this point, but this is just more of my own observations. These kind of, you know, micro school infrastructures with in-person learning to accompany the digital learning is a way to obviate the obvious problems and shortfalls that typically accompany. It's not the only way, but it seems like a really effective way, right, to mitigate the shortfalls of digital learning. And it won't be long until districts are doing that, is my prediction. They'll have to, because someone else is going to do it, and maybe they'll get the first mover advantage. And I got to tell you, some of the most innovative educators I know are people that work in districts, right? Like, they're actually in there, right? And some of them have been pushing the ball forward on these things. There's some really basic, you know, nuts and bolt politics that prevent school districts from being as innovative as they should be. For instance, it's not unusual to see school districts with a lot of empty space in buildings and with high demand magnet programs, yeah. But they don't replicate their high demand magnet programs, right? They've got wait lists, just like charter life. They've got a wait list. That's great. The district I live in right now, Scottsdale Unified, is 40% vacant. 40% vacant, and they have magnet programs with giant wait lists. Like, well, gee, I don't know. Why don't you like create 5 of these things? And the answer is, this is not hard to figure out, right? The existing other schools in the district see it as a threat, right? They don't want 5 any more than they want 5 new charter schools, right? And so it doesn't happen, right? This is why it's so important that we have an impetus towards change and innovation coming from the outside, right? These districts really struggle politically to reform themselves, right? However, they are capable of it with enough outside pressure, and they're I don't think there's going to be more of that in the future than there has been in the past.
You know, the pandemic, certainly in Florida, but I'm sure around the country, is really devastating a lot of enrollment in district schools. You know, in Florida, it seems to be a lot of districts are down 5 to 10%, which is huge. Now they're trying to get some of the kids back. They're sending people to homes, knocking on doors, doing everything they possibly can to get these kids back. But I would presume that you're probably going to have sort of a permanent 5% decrease in attendance. And as more of these innovations roll out, you can see that the enrollment in these district schools start to shrink. So at a certain point, you would think that they're going to start competing and saying, okay, we can also do a Success Academy kind of approach, like you've been articulating, and we can, you know, turn some of our really innovative educators loose. It'll be interesting to see how that works. The other thing that's interesting to me is, you know, I spent 15 years as a teacher union leader, so I'm very well aware of teachers complaining about dysfunctional systems, because my job was to protect teachers from a dysfunctional system. That's how you organize unions.
Right.
Be interesting to see if the union model can evolve, because a lot of teachers would really benefit from a support system if the teacher unions would let them organize micro schools and be part of homeschool co-ops. And I mean, the unions have historically pushed for a top-down command and control organization, because that's how collective bargaining works.
Right.
But there's different models out there that if the unions would partner with the school districts and be innovative, they could really move the ball down the road as opposed to fighting to the bitter end.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the posts I wrote early on after I came on board with Redefined about, you know, the reality before the pandemic, right? The status quo was not sustainable before the pandemic,
right?
Enrollment in colleges of education around the country, you know, dropped by 40%, right? We're not attracting people into the profession. It's not only the case that, you know, baby boomer under a typical, you know, so typically a state has something called the rule of 80. I don't know if they have that here in Florida, but rule of 80 says you're eligible to retire once your age plus your years of service reaches 80. Okay. That's kind of a rule of thumb around the country. Right. Okay. So the other day it occurred to me, like, someone my age, right? I'm 53. I'm a Gen Xer, right? So I graduated from college in 1990. What if I had started teaching in 1990? When would I have been eligible to retire? And the answer is 2 years ago.
Right.
Okay. All the baby boomers are basically eligible to retire now, right? Your Gen Xers are also, right? And some states have tweaked this and are like, well, we can take it from 80 to 85. Well, under rule of 85, guess what? I'm eligible to retire next year.
Right.
Right. So we're not attracting people into the profession, right? The people that we have in the profession now increasingly are eligible to retire. States have underfunded pension systems, very bad. Florida's done very well on that, by the way, but most states have really, and there's 10,000 baby boomers per day reaching the age of 65, and that creates this conflict between public health care spending and education. Now, does that mean public education is going away? No, public education is not going away, right? State constitutions guarantee state funding for K-12 education, right? The public overwhelmingly supports that guarantee, right? Now, so it won't be going away, but I think that the pandemic was just basically a really unexpected big curveball that is sort of the opening stanza of what's going to be a very difficult decade for public education. You know, there's also a baby bust that is clearly established in the data now. The higher education people are watching it inch up their way, and they're really terrified by it. The impetus has always been to preserve the system as it was, warts and all, to turn a blind eye to the gigantic equity problems that were in the public education system itself. This is like a common problem, right? People in our discussions of K-12 policy, people start with an assumption that the public education system is equitable, and anything you want to do outside that system is inherently inequitable. the reality is the public education system is profoundly inequitable in a lot of different ways, starting with a gigantic amount of racial and economic segregation that is sort of the foundation of the system. The status quo was never an option even without the pandemic, right? With the pandemic, I think things have been kind of accelerated about a decade, like some things that were already bubbling up. The micro schools trend was already bubbling up in places like Silicon Valley before the pandemic. When the pandemic struck, it was Silicon Valley that basically spearheaded the effort to encourage people to form pandemic pods. The status quo was going to change anyway, but now it's going to change faster and different than it was before.
Before we end, I'm just curious. Imagine it's 10 years from now. Paint me a picture of what we're going to see with ESAs, with all this innovation. I mean, what's your crystal ball tell you?
I think what we're going to see is that there are a lot of people, that increasing number of people, are going to be very actively engaged in what we might describe as multi-vendor education. They will be doing something that looks like a sort of an ESA world, whether they're paying for it themselves or not. And this has been going on for a decade amongst higher income people. But a lot of people have gotten to peer into the world of their school by looking over the shoulder of their child into a Zoom classroom, and have not always been thrilled about what they're seeing, right? I think that happens no matter what, right? Like, I think the micro schooling is going to become more prevalent. The only question is are we going to rise to the occasion and address the equity issues involved, right? The ability for us to address the equity issues involved has to involve public funding, right? It just does. Like, some people can afford to go hire their private teacher, the DJ on People Magazine. I don't think that's a problem for him, right? And he loves doing what he's doing because, again, when you go and visit these things, your instant reaction is like, wow, I'd love to have my kid doing this. This is great, right? So I think the public policy issue that is going to face us is, are we going to, ignore this? Are we going to, try to ban people from doing this? Or are we going to get serious and try to provide, avenues for disadvantaged families and disadvantaged students to also participate in these types of activities? So I think 10 years from now, there will certainly still be a public school system, and a lot of it will still be operating as it does today, right? But I think we're going to see a far more pluralistic system with a lot of different options, and I think that we're going to also see a lot of policymakers that are going to, bite the bullet to do what it takes to help disadvantaged families participate.